What's up, guys? This is Danny from Rethink Peer-to-Peer Lending. Today, guest at the Escated office, we have Mathis Antzvisoulis.
Yo.
And we got Davis Behrens, also one of the shareholders from Escated, and Vitalis Svalos, obviously the CEO of Escated. Guys, thanks so much for having me today in your office using this beautiful podcast environment that you usually have.
Beautiful microphones.
And yeah, today I would like to, you know, just address a couple of current challenges that Escated is facing and just getting an overall idea about how Escated is performing at the moment. So looking at the numbers, maybe it's a good idea to start off. Escated is entering now its fourth year of its operations.
Is it fourth?
Yeah.
And
time flies, so.
And maybe just to start off, a question I always ask quite open to any platform that I visit, what's your current perception of Escated? Where do you see your platform at the moment? What's the status quo? How would you evaluate the situation at this point in time?
I think we're the best and we want to change nothing in the P2P space. Summary. No, but I don't know. We have, I think, had very good success over the last 2 years. Now, maybe we have not enough volume to post for investors. That's the biggest challenge, if we speak about challenges. Other than that, I think we're in a good position.
So, good. Definitely, that's the case. But then we're also changing our sort of situation as a company. We were as a startup for a long time, and then we're transitioning into a scale-up. So that always comes with change, how you approach things, what you do. And I think soon we're going to have quite a few new asset originators. And we're still learning that process. And once we harness basically that, then I think there's going to be a lot of growth. So
yeah, I think I can just add that we were kind of thinking that it will be a bit faster with adding some supply for investors. In last 6 months we have checked something like 20 asset originators, and we want to bring only good stuff for our investors. And between those 20, it was not like we have seen something very good that we would want to deliver to our investors. It's not like we want to post everything, because we know what can happen if we would be having such a thinking for that process. So yeah, that's why, as Davis said, it takes some time for us to kind of adjust the process and to understand what exactly we want and need, and then most probably the supply will again be back there, and it will again be as it was like 6 months ago, I would say, something like this.
Before we discuss the supply situation a bit further, let's just reflect on, let's say, the first 3 years of your operations. I would say you had tremendous success in growing quite fast and scaling up quite fast, so growing a loan book of almost 40 million euro in the first 3 years. Now, I know entrepreneurs used to like drop big numbers from the beginning and feel like, okay, we're going to take over the world. But have you been surprised by an extent about the growth you had in the first couple of years?
We were surprised about how little it was, yeah.
I think like compared to our lending businesses, which is our core business, we didn't have necessarily like a massive objective for the platform in terms of volume or in terms of products or in terms of partnerships or the format of how it should look like. We built it right in the beginning as a way to fund our lending businesses, and maybe because of that, like I said, we didn't have expectations or some pressure internally to be some kind of a platform or to be the best in the space or something like that. But nevertheless, we have had decent growth, but primarily because we had the infrastructure, the experience, the reputation before that, right? If we would have started the platform from scratch, you know, in this industry, then probably it would have taken us a long time, as we see sometimes with platforms that are just starting from nothing. So it was very important that we had these loan originators like Green Finance, Avafin, then Jordan, and so on.
But then obviously the infrastructure is one, then having also, let's say, the confidence from the market and the trust from investors that can, you know, also fuel that supply. And, you know, the demand has been quite significant, I would say. Is that, you know, is that really just based from the good reputation you build up with Cream Finance prior, or?
I would say primarily, and that was a big part of the whole success of Escated, right? Our success with Cream Finance and now Avafin for the last 12 years. You know, the company is well known in the space. We as founders and our team members are well known in the space. Compare that to a new project which came from nothing, or compare that to most of the platforms where you can find out who are UBOs and things like that. So, you know, it's no wonder that. Mm.
Where do you see currently the challenges on the supply side? What is the reason that, you know, you can't fuel that demand anymore, let's say particular in this year where book has grown roughly by a million so far?
I think we underestimated how difficult it would be to find good asset originators in the market. So, you know, as Vitalis mentioned, that's a big thing. You would go through 20, 30, 40 companies until you find something that is fit by our standards. We underestimated the cycle, the length of the cycle. Once you start the due diligence on asset originator, do the terms of the deal and, you know, have them onboarded, that is taking a lot. And then, obviously, we need to build out the internal capacity to do all of that process, because that's a little bit different from consumer lending and from managing the platform, right? In essence. So I think those factors combined, we are lingering at the volume we are for a couple of months now, or for half a year, I guess.
I would add another thing, which is that if we would have decided at some point that we want to be growing volume, no matter what, and onboarding third-party loan originators or onboarding some kind of new products and just creating, you know, a big platform for the sake of growth and volume, or for the sake of having a place to invest always for investors, then maybe we would have been 2, 3, 4 times bigger. But me and Davis's decision, or rather indecisiveness at this stage about not necessarily wanting to do that, is also part of the reason. It's not like we want to be Mintos or something like that. You know, we're not very keen on having tons of different companies on the platform. And so I think that's also kind of being selective, hard loan origination or onboarding process, but also we're still kind of thinking, what do we do with this potential? That there are investors that want to invest. We have a limited number of our own companies, and then there's this potential, but we're it's still a question of, you know, how to best manage it, especially if you add on the regulation aspect. Mm.
So do you see the growth mostly coming from external lenders that are, let's say, neither owned by you guys? And I would also, you know, take out Avafin from this equation. Is this the primarily source where you see the growth coming from in the future?
I would say both probably. So we have the thing with our loan originators. We have a few in the Middle East that take much longer than other loan originators that we've built in the past to launch and scale. But those are high potential businesses that are in the pipeline, and hopefully we'll launch them like end of this year, early next year, let's say. So there's like a buildup of companies in our own pipeline, our own loan originators. In terms of the third party ones, to be honest, it's a bit hard to even predict. Like, you go into a conversation with a company that looks great, and then like 6 months down the line, you understand you're still not agreeing on like some basic terms, or there's some due diligence, et cetera, question. So like with certainty, I know what we can control. Those are our loan originators, and they'll be coming like closer to the end of the year with decent scale. And also spawn the capital will be growing for sure, where we buy portfolios. About the other ones, I mean, that will be a cherry on the top.
And I wouldn't agree that we're taking out Avafin from the equation. I mean, it's still going to be part of Esketit, and Avafin has its own grand plans of expanding in Europe and in Mexico, where they have a great business. And as they will be expanding, their need for cash will grow. So we're going to be with them, I think, going for the years to come. So. Mm.
I also would like to go deeper into Avafin, but let's just wrap up. One second, the question of, let's say, I was wondering, like, Vitalis was sharing with me, like, the outstanding portfolio split by lenders. And for me, it's interesting to see, let's say, at this point in time, the loan book, 60% from that portfolio comes from lenders that are owned by you guys, the main shareholders of Esketit. But also those lending companies, as you mentioned, Spender Capital, Mojo Capital, or primarily now also then with Money for Finance. a lot of lenders are owned by yourself. Do you, let's say, have an internal look at how you want to diversify the lender structure and in terms of like where the ownership lies?
Actually, we wanted all the lenders be ours on the schedule back in the day, because that was the promise to investors, and that was the whole idea, right? Because once you become less involved in the operations, you have less control over it, and then more surprises are coming over the years. And we understood that this is not really, you know, possible. So we want to have a healthy proportion of quality asset originators, and in the third-party asset originators that are going to be coming, we might be shareholders as well, not to the full extent, not 100% shareholders, but shareholders of a decent proportion, so we have impact in the company. And this is also one of the strategies we're having, is to have, let's say, more serious partnership with these asset originators and becoming an equity investors there alongside with Esketit's financing.
Mm. Can you explain why you sold your shares of Avafin to Capitec Bank over the years?
I needed the money. How else do you buy the Lambo?
I mean, Range Rovers or whatever.
Yeah, Range Rovers. Yeah. Okay, go for it.
I mean, it was a great story. Capitec was a great partner. It's an amazing company. You know, more power to them, and we're stunned seeing their growth while they're
very stunned.
Yeah, pretty much stunned. You know, they grew market cap 2 times.
More than two times
while they were with us since 2015 when we started talking about the deal, and for what is that, 10 billion market cap company? That's amazing. So good luck to them with Avafin in expanding in Europe. But for us, it was many things together, and one of them is that we felt like the chapter had to be closed. You had, you know, a lot of a legacy in the company, you had many shareholders, you had dilution there, which was not favorable for us. We had an opportunity of exiting to, you know, one of the best banks in the world. So, of course, we did it. You know, it's like a no-brainer, pretty much.
And I would just add that, we had this successful run with the business. Raised money from Capitec. They became a strategic partner, and once a public bank is your strategic, basically biggest investor, it kind of means certain things. It means the company becomes more corporate. And me and Avs, we're company builders, as it's cool to say, company builders and entrepreneurs. So for us, the environment wasn't exactly the sort of place where we could do what we want in a way we want, ideally. And we had already very capable, basically independent management in place since, I don't know, like 2018, 17, Patrick and the rest of the team. And so we just decided that that's time to step down from the management. And then once we were off the management, of course, we were more interested to having, you know, cash in the bank rather than shares. It's not like, Facebook or something. And then the rest of Dave's mentioned.
Was there also, let's say, an emotional sentiment to it? Because obviously, Cream Finance is so much the origin from your story in the lending business, more or less, right?
You know, it's not like a surprise. You wake up one day and all of a sudden you don't have a company, you know, so that's and the cash on your mattress. No, it's like it's a long process. You know, the process took, what is that? We started the process of the sale before COVID.
5 years.
Then COVID hit. We had a pause of like 1.5 or 2 years. Then we restarted the process. Then we had multiple offers from, you know, global concerns and then companies. And then our existing shareholder kind of said, okay, you know, let's stop the game and we'll buy it. So it was a long process, and there's enough time to assimilate what's happening, how it's happening. Of course, it's interesting to do the deal, see how it's happening on the world level. So, no hard feelings. I think everybody came out happy from the deal. All of our shareholders are made multimillionaires there. So it's like...
Especially, you know, the first seed, the small seed investors or consultants. Some of them, they didn't put any money in it and they made the most in return. So shout out to them.
This morning I was looking at your what was it? Like your report panel discussion or the kind of presentation you had. I don't know where it was, about how to fundraise millions and the lessons you learned along the way.
In the presentation I did?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was like seminar like seminar. Two months ago. So.
Yeah. And one thing that came to my mind, like reflecting, or you were reflecting on the struggles at the very early beginning, like I think like getting 30,000 euro for 45% of Volker, the company.
Our very first investor. I was just going to go meet him soon, actually.
Okay.
You're going, yeah?
September.
Yeah.
Okay. And then actually something that I was curious about, like back in the day, have you like thought about, like you were at the, you know, just at the get-go of building a company, but have you thought also about the exit already at the very beginning? And was this always a target of yours to sell this company at one point, or do you looked at it more as, okay, this is going to be like my baby and I nurture it throughout the years and it's always be with me? Or how did you think about the exit from the very early days?
For whom this question is, you want to answer? For people that start businesses or for... You know,
who needs
the answer will be different then.
No, I'm just curious, like, did you have an exit in mind already, or like, I'm gonna build companies to sell them? Or
me and Davis, for me, I don't even remember, to be honest, like how I felt about thinking about the exit. We were just excited that there was something that kind of works and that we are, you know, in the deep end and we have to figure out how to get this money, etc. I don't remember like thinking about the exits. Mm-hmm. At one point, I do remember that we, you know, kind of felt like this could be a tech company, a VC type of business that you could fundraise and sell. Mm-hmm. That I do remember, and that was a mistake strategically, because it's not a tech company. You cannot sell it as
a
VC.
And it's not a VC business.
And it's not a VC fundable business, and so on and so forth. And with that, I do remember we decided to pay attention to things that are important in a kind of VC story. Therefore, we were thinking about a sale potentially, ideally, as a way to make money from this business. And that was, I think, like 2015, 16, around that period of time. Mm. And so that I do remember. But then, and I think this relationship with the sale of the business, it kind of keeps changing as you develop and as you understand the business better and so on. So there's not like one specific answer.
Okay. Did the new ownership structure change the way funds have been allocated to Esketit? Because it seems like, you know, I think the portfolio right now is around 12 million on Esketit. Is that it seems to be quite stagnant. Did anything change from the restructuring of the ownership?
The glorious CFO, Peter.
I was thinking, should we mention his name?
Yeah, we did.
Giving him too much airtime.
So Peter is very prudent CFO, so he likes to diversify risks, and therefore Esketit is just one of the funding sources there, one of the four or five.
Very risky one.
Yeah. So that's where we are, you know, and he has a full authority over those decisions, which we're very happy for.
Peter, doing a good job, man.
Yeah. So, you know, let him do his job. When the company grows and we still are one of the four funding sources for Avafin, the portfolio will grow, right? So that's, you know, that's in the plans. And I think Avafin's budget for 25, 26 implies quite a lot of growth. So that's going to happen.
But yes. And also their company now, they've blown 100% or almost 100% to Capitec, and so Capitec has obviously deep pockets, so they will be able to provide some funding on their side.
Hopefully, but that's not
certain. We just hear rumors.
Okay. Did you consider like how, let's say, funding from Avafin could dry up with the new ownership change, and did you also felt like this could have an impact on the Esketit operations to a bigger extent?
No.
Even if they do decide to pull out the money for some strange reasons, I mean, I will replace it, not instantly, but over time. So. Hmm.
So there's no more say, or there has been no contractual agreement in terms of like, and for some sort of transition period, we want to ensure a certain funding from Avafin on Esketit.
And this is, I think, great that you asked this question. Esketit and Avafin has the same contractual obligations as Esketit and Credus, Esketit and Axiom, and Esketit and any other asset originator, right? And the relationship is the same.
Yeah,
so
what's on
you
paper.
Know
yeah.
What's on paper, and the contract is the same for all companies. So if they, for whatever reason, decide to extend, we're happy, right? Our investors are, you know, interested in Avafin as an asset class, and as a company. So. But what we know and what we foresee, there's no drying up, you know. There's just more volume planned.
Mm. I'm just assuming because, let's say, considering their size and also the size they have in terms of, like, on Esketit, might have, you know, given you certain ideas about, okay, we want to ensure like there's also a certain level of funding coming from Avafin moving forward. And
for me, and that was the mentality, is we shouldn't be dependent on any one loan originator to any extent unless it's owned fully by us. And so Avafin or no Avafin on a scattered platform, I mean, we want to be in a position where it doesn't really matter. That's kind of...
That's the plan.
Right?
And I think also it's worth to add that for lenders, platforms usually is a flexible funding, and that means that with help of platforms, they can kind of lower and higher the funded volumes. So, for example, if you take bonds, you are kind of quite fixed to the volume that you have funded. But with the platform, you can go up 1 month, and another month you can go again lower, and then you can kind of manage your funding sources in such a way, and platform helps for this. So, and this we also kind of see with Avafin. So, for example, they have been a bit higher. Now they are a bit lower. We know that they will again be higher. So it will be just fluctuating throughout the months, most probably.
Yeah, but also, obviously, our position has changed from back in 5 years ago, or like, let's say, 3 years ago when we started the Scatit. We were obviously shareholders in the Scatit. So the relationship was much closer and much more cooperation. And now it's a third-party loan originator. Mm-hmm.
Closing the chapter with Avafin, maybe just the very end. When are new assets coming from Avafin? Now, you mentioned the Mexican lender, but I think that's in the air already for quite some time. If I remember like hearing this some, I don't know, 6 months ago or something. So why are there no new assets coming, and what's the forecast you have at the moment?
You came in the wrong moment to ask this question, to be honest, because we are, what, 2, 3, 4 weeks away from a new asset originator?
Yeah.
Hopefully. Yeah, so that's what we've been working on for quite some time.
Not Avafin.
Yeah.
Not Avafin, yeah. Yeah. So that's going to be a new one. On Avafin Mexico, what do you want me to tell us?
No, I mean, it's not, so if they will want to post something, they will, and we're happy. If not, then no, we don't have any active discussions with Alice.
Yeah, just also to say why we have kind of historically said that they will come, and now it's still not, they are still not there. Just the thing is that also on Avafin, they have had enough of the cash on their side, and that's why it was enough for them. 1 month they saw that they will not have enough cash of that, and then they had great results, and that delivered kind of more cash for them, so they didn't need the cash from Scatit, and that's why the situation was kind of changing every month, and then we are still in the situation that they don't need that funding as such, and that's why they are not there, and that's just a simple answer for this.
Mm. All right, let's switch to the lending business in Jordan. I'm curious, like I'm following like the recent vlog that you posted also, and visiting the, what was it, the Minister of Investment and Finance?
Yes,
there?
Minister of Investments. Very
Minister of Investment. Yeah. I was curious, like, how is the operating a lending business in the Middle East different compared to Europe? What are the key things that distinguish?
It's more profitable and it's easier than in Europe.
Definitely easier.
No, but Jordan is a great country in a sense where it is positioned geopolitically maybe not today, but as in a stage of development it is. Yeah. Right? It has decent population size. It has very good rule of law. The economy is kind of diversified. There are a lot of, how to say, middle income people, right? They wouldn't be considered middle income by European standards, but you know, by Middle Eastern standards, they are. And the infrastructure is yet to be developed. So I think from the timing perspective, we are in the sweetest spot there. You know, 5, 6 years ago, it was not possible. Now it is possible. And I think we as a company are going to grow together with the Jordanian finance sector, right? And we have quite ambitious plans there. Mm. So.
Maybe from my position, so... specifically, Jordan is, it's a cash-based economy, so there's a lot of stuff going on in cash. Also, we have lending in branches, as you probably know. We have sales agents and things like that are all manual, not manual, but you know, labor-intensive operations. So that's what makes it probably different from Europe, let's say, because in Europe it's all, you know, very automated and so on. So that's one big thing. And the second big thing, which is massive, is obviously the cultural difference. It's a very different culture. And thank God we have Liga, the CEO of the business. We have a very good local country manager at the end of the day, very strong by now, very strong executive team, leaders of different departments. That took 3 years to build out that stability. And we have a very strong head office here that kind of controls the operations in Amman. But their biggest challenge always has been this, the cultural gap in the country versus how we are used to doing things. Speed of delivering, kind of standards for not excellence, but standards for delivering tasks, right? Are a different understanding between the different countries. So that has been something that we had to work very hard to be on the same page with people on the ground there. And the third thing is that this product and fintech, as I've said, it's a new thing in the country. So we are like miles ahead or years ahead in our know-how, and things that for us are second nature are something that we're very used to. All sorts of ways of running a business, building a company, you know, with the product, etc. We had to train the local team and also the customers that this is how it works and it makes sense, and trust us that it's going to be, you know, good. So those things have made it difficult from a kind of a people management perspective.
I'll add one more thing about the regulation. So there's in Jordan, there's a very competent and strict regulator, Central Bank.
Very smart guys.
To which we have applied for a license, and it seems like the regulator, for many reasons, extended the licensing process. Most probably, they just cannot cope with the amount of applications they have there. But it's a very heavy license, so this means a lot of companies won't be able to comply with the requirements and with the capital requirements. And we're in a good position there. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. There was a lot of good cues that we can pick up on. One of the first things was the geopolitical risk. I'm curious, like, how do you assess the situation at the moment?
Listen, I think the context and the field of information has to be considered when we talk about these things, right? For Middle East, I think that's what you're referring to, right? The situation is very familiar. Nobody's surprised there, and I think it seems much more active and important here in Europe because it's multiplied by media. You know, the whole thing. When you are in Dubai, when you are in Riyadh, when you are in Oman, you just pretty much don't hear about these things, right? So there is action happening in different places at different times and different intensity. And that has been the case for, 50 years.
Yeah.
And most probably that will be the case for the next 50 years. I don't know. But the region as such is extremely well situated. It's growing like on steroids. I mean, if you want a growth market for any industry, any product, you name it, you know, that's Middle East. I would not look at that region solely from, there's war happening in many places and it might escalate and things like that. I mean, if those things happen to a grand extent, then I think all of us sitting here are gonna have different type of problems, right? We are very sort of calm about that situation, right, from that perspective.
I would argue that also, let's say, the situation in Ukraine seemed like unimaginable many years ago, and the situation that happened still, you know, I see that you're quite often in Jordan, but, you know, do you take any, let's say, precautionary measures, you know, understanding like you're growing quite fast, but is there any, you know, considerations in place on how you can adjust your operations in case, you know, the war should extend in the Middle East?
So we are always making sure that our customer portfolio and our credit risk is in a very good position. I think that's, you know, that is the case. You will speak to one of our risk people later on, and he'll explain you that. Even if we look at Ukrainian situation and what happened there in after 22, most of the companies that were well run have survived and they are back in the game and profitable, right? So even if there is a shock of some sort, you know, it wouldn't be nationwide and it it wouldn't be something of a black swan event where from which country cannot recover, right? So that's not the country at risk, let's put it that way. There are other places that are at, of this risk. There we don't do business and we don't intend to do business there.
So. Yeah, maybe I would add that, you know, there are things we cannot control, obviously. You know, war can spread in many different places. Middle East, historically, not the most stable for sure. But what we can control is what we do control, which is the quality of our business, of our operations. And if you think about it, where we don't have manufacturing sites and things like that, where we have done like 20 or 50 year investment kind of investments with a long time horizon, the worst comes to worst, in essence, in our business, what we need to make sure is that our client portfolio is bigger and better than the liabilities, the debt that we have taken on to issue those loans. And so if we need to stop lending and kind of cease operations or suspend operations for some time, you know, if force majeure, like worst case scenario comes, we are, you know, we can do that. And we have had very challenging experiences in places like Sri Lanka, for example, which has gone through COVID. It has gone through 60% foreign like currency rate drop. What else? Flood. Like freaking everything you can imagine that country has been through over the last 2 years, and and we decided to kind of stick through it as opposed to just shut down right from the beginning. And Igor, our Sri Lanka CEO, is managing it very, very, very well. And we have seen there like a shitstorm after shitstorm, and the business still continues
and profitably.
Like last whole year has been like profitable. So the point is, we have experience of like going through these very tough situations. Hopefully, nothing like that happens in Jordan. But if it does, it's, you know, it's not, we're not the first rodeo, so to speak. Mm.
Do you know maybe top of your head how long the, let's say, average maturities are from the German portfolio?
They below 30 days.
Yeah,
like short-term portfolio. And that's another reason why we are so confident in this business model, that it can survive through major crises. You know, if you understand that something like that is happening, then you would liquidate your portfolio, and then, you know, quite fast, that can be doable.
So. All right. Yeah, another cue I want to pick up. The way of lending, you know, you said like there's a lot of offline branches, brick and mortar stores, also a difference, I guess, compared to Europe, where most of the lending business gets more and more automated, I'm assuming. Can you talk about what's the split and what's the share between offline and online lending in Jordan?
Offline and online?
Yes.
It depends on what
looking
you mean
at
by
the
split.
Volume.
Is split in terms of how we attract customers, split in terms of how we issue
the
loans.
Volume, yes.
Yeah. So most of the loans, over 50%, we attract offline.
Clients.
Offline through agents, through branches, and through digital branches, which is cooperation with partners where we set up our branches, and then the issuance of loans. It's almost 100% offline, because there are things missing in the infrastructure, confirming identity online end to end for a customer in Jordan. Either it's like very difficult, or it's almost impossible to do for an average consumer. So it's mostly offline.
And there's another. So you have to think about a cultural aspect, right? I mean, if you go to Egypt, you see people hanging around the cash machines, you know, place where you have cash machines, and I was like, why is that? So they like to hang out at these places, and you know, for whatever reason, I don't know. And then our agent model and our branch model allows the people to have that place where to hang out, and then, you know, they like it. This is funny as it is, you know, that is the case. So they need a place to go, they need a manager to look at, you know, to tell them how they feel today, and then, you know, do the transactions, you know, to get the loan. So and it is different in different parts of the world. For us, it kind of it seems funny. For them, they would say, oh, how can you do that without a personal contact, without not knowing who gave you the loans? Like, totally alien for them. So, you know, we just accommodate whatever is the local culture there. So.
You made it sound a bit like, okay, you have a lounge in your branches and maybe some drinks are offered and
shisha.
We don't have shisha, but drinks are offered and you can have a seat there, yeah.
Yeah,
yes, true. And then you can have a number, you know, for the sequence which you're in.
Digital queue.
Digital queue, yeah.
Can you give me an idea? Obviously, I guess there's also differences in Europe, but let's say across Europe, like how the lending online versus offline, how it distinguishes and what the numbers are in Europe?
I don't know.
I mean, offline-online split in lending, in consumer lending in Europe?
Yeah.
I think it's mostly like online. I remember in Poland, there were a lot of sales agents where basically you have like this random guy that lives in some house somewhere in Suwalki or whatever. I don't know if it's a...
But that was a business Italian model.
That's a sales, distribution channel. So you have a person that's an individual, they have a house and they have this one room where people from the community would go to that one room. And that's like a small branch. And in that room, you have number of offers from different loan originators. And that person would be able to choose, okay, I want this loan originator, and then they fill out the form, and then the guy that is facilitating the process would send the application to that loan originator. Yeah. And that's a way to attract offline to attract customers. And that did exist in Poland. I believe it still exists in Poland.
In Czech Republic, it's still the case.
Or in Czech Republic. And I'm sure in like southern part of Europe also, like probably a lot of places like that. But that's that. I mean,
on Greek islands, it's still happening the same.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, yeah. The world is a big place. There's not only a Revolut and, you know, places like this. There's a lot of things happening. Mm-hmm. So.
True.
Let's talk about the licensing regulation in Jordan.
Again,
you were pretty excited, according to
totally
the video
excited,
I saw.
Man. That's our favorite topic.
But you seem quite confident and excited about this process. Is that something, you know, is that just...
You mean for Jordan?
Yes.
Because we are, so...
What's the difference, maybe, because I remember from our last on-camera conversation, you were, let's say, expressing your...
Sadness?
...dissatisfaction about the Latvian regulator pretty obviously.
I don't know. So, I mean, my short answer, in Jordan, it's a double-edged sword. So from one perspective, it's a barrier to entry and it makes your business more stable, predictable, easier maybe to fund, etc. So that is great. And you know where you are in terms of, you know, relationship with the regulator. So that we are looking forward to, that's one. And also for the benefit in our specific case, as Dajis mentioned, it's a high barrier to entry because of the paid capital. It's effectively like getting a bank license. I mean, I'd say probably equivalent. You have to have AML.
How much money is involved?
5 million JOD, 7 million euros paid capital. Yeah, and plus a ton of like processes, AML departments, compliance, etc. So from that perspective, we're building kind of moats around the business. From the perspective of okay, you have a regulator that tells you what you cannot and can do. Obviously, it's more difficult, and you are probably slower and so on. So that's probably the downside in Jordan. But in the long term, more interested in having a regulated business than an unregulated business. For what you mentioned, for Latvian regulator, my stance is, so the Latvian regulator is like overreaching and is extremely, how to say, conservative when it comes to all the AML and source of funds, checks and compliance and requirements. And that's it's a disease, effectively. In the economy, it's a disease because you cannot, you know, do transactions from bank to bank. And that everybody knows. It's not my opinion. You know, everybody has like the same absolute opinion. And that is a reaction to the other extreme that we were in before 2014 or whenever the U.S. government came. Where we were laundering like Russian money, like there's no tomorrow. So now we're
we
had a bit of that going on, man.
Like, a bit of that, yeah.
Yeah. And with Apple, with these companies. And now we're on the other side of that spectrum where, you know, you cannot make a fart and not make a compliance report about it. So that's my take.
Also, I think, how to say, Jordanian regulator is more pro country, pro their people. So they're very welcoming for the businesses. You know, they in all the ministries we were and the way we got greeted, it was just like unparalleled. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, yeah, guys, come over, do business here. It's like, you know,
I'll
bring
give you
your
my
friends.
Phone. Yeah, like, you know, let's make it happen.
And I don't think that's the case in Latvia. That's one thing. And for whatever reasons, and these reasons are beyond our reach and beyond our sort of you know, influence, so we don't want to go there. But if you look at Estonian model, and that cycle takes 20 years to prove itself, right, where you had a lot of startups and very welcoming environment for startups, that created the ecosystem and the unicorns. And now it created all those exits and millionaires and billionaires that are the local people and that like to invest back into their, you know, economy and the cities where they came from. And that brings money back. So in Latvia, we don't see that trend, or we don't see this type of cycle being developed, which is sad. You know, if you compare Vilnius, Riga and Tallinn, you know, Riga is pretty much empty place. Compared to very vibrant life in Tallinn, and nothing against Riga, I love the place, but it's just sad to see what's happening. You know, so
there are some obviously lately, last year, couple of years, guys doing startup schools and accelerators and things like that, which is obviously very nice. But yeah,
how big would you say is the market share that you have in Jordan right now?
100%?
Close. Let's leave it.
I mean,
something.
Depends also what you mean by which is what market. If you mean unsecured short-term consumer loans,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Then like, I don't know.
Yeah. Close.
80%?
80.
Like,
yeah, should be 80. I think we are the top player in the country.
Yeah. And if you mean non-banking lending providers, that also include non-banking SME providers, these microfinance organizations and so on, then by portfolio size, we're not big at all. There are companies that are on the market for 20, 30 years. They have like hundreds of millions in portfolio. By number of customers, we are also, I don't know, top 5, top 3, something, compared to all those non-bank finance companies, regardless of what product they do. By number of customers, so we have a lot of customers in a short span of time. Yeah,
interesting metrics. Thanks for sharing. I'm curious, like with the regulation, is it like a mandatory element coming now to Jordan, or
it's a mandatory element? And there will be no companies operating without a license. The local authorities don't fuck around. It's not going to be, you know, a call from a regulator. It's going to be, you know, behind the bars instantly. So there's you know, there's a very strong ruler there, right? So there's no ambiguity. You know, you don't have the license, you just don't do stuff. Mm. That's very straightforward. And therefore, we are in talks with the regulator to expand our product offering, to expand our sort of, you know, lines of business there in Jordan. Yeah, mm. But
how do you perceive this change? I'm very curious, because understanding, let's say, your starting, your origin, let's say back from the Green Finance days, when you were pretty much, okay, regulation is really like restricting the non-bank lending sector, and now you're kind of like in this position of kind of affording it and understanding maybe you can cut out a certain level of competition. How do you perceive this transition the last 10, 15 years?
I mean, it's exactly as you said. Ideally, in the beginning, you're not regulated, so you have like runway to become bigger, to start making money and to have the muscle. And then the regulation comes, and that adds in your favor because you're established and you can afford to have a regulation. And that's a moat. It's a barrier to entry for newcomers. And if you have that timing right, like we have had in Jordan so far, and we have not had it in many other places, like when we started in Latvia, we came in, we had no money, we were just like, you know, 20 something year old guys, no understanding of what's going on. And then the same year as we started, or like a year later, the government came in to say, okay, now you have 70,000 license, 350,000 or like a half a million euro paid capital requirement. And obviously, guys in SMS Credits, they were fucking laughing because it's amazing because all the little companies will disappear. And we had to like, kind of survive somehow that one. And that was more negative because we had not had that runway, for example.
But as a group of companies, we also evolve, right? So now having the regulation game, it's a normal game for us. All the business, we had so many businesses that are regulated, so we're used to that. All of the businesses we run as if regulated, even those who are not. So we want to be compliant, and we are here for the long game. And I think the real growth will just start happening in some time. And for that, you need a solid foundation. There's no other way around it, right? It doesn't mean that you have to be, over-regulated. Esketit is one of the examples. You know, we're using the possibilities provided by law, right? We're going to do that as long as that's beneficial. At the moment, when it becomes unbeneficial, we're going to do what's required to sustain, grow, and develop the business. So.
And then maybe just to wrap up, I want to quickly discuss the latest venture that you published, also on Esketit, Mojo Capital. Can you talk about what the idea is behind?
So we have an idea to, like Dave said, to provide loans, and not only loans, also equity to businesses that we are interested in, potentially as shareholders. Most of those would be lending businesses, loan originators, and so we thought we'll create a separate vehicle where we have a way to do that, like some corporate, like a our own VC venture debt company through which we would do these investments and loans. And that's the idea behind it. And the focus would be on emerging markets as opposed to Europe, most likely. Since we have this business in Jordan, we have a project going on in Saudi and in that Middle East region, it is a bit kind of focused on that part of the world, but not necessarily. So, yeah.
And then also there's a little bit of the reason why it's there, you cannot always structure the deals with Saudi Arabia, with Jordan, through Europe, right? So you need a SPV in order to structure those deals. And then we would be looking at, as Matti said, becoming shareholders in businesses, but all of those businesses are in the sector of lending in, of one sort of or another, be it SME, be it consumer, short-term, long-term, right? So we don't want to deviate away from our know-how or expertise, right? We want to stay in that what do you call it, sector, yeah? But for now, many projects focused on Middle East, later on, yeah, elsewhere. But there's, a lot to do for the years to come. So. Mm.
And what is this new school project about?
What is this new school? Oh, man, it's a grand idea. Come on. The new school. So basically, the idea with new school is that we want to, provide lending services as a white label business model, because we are used to and we know how to do lending from a balance sheet for a very long time across many countries and so on. And we thought maybe there is also a business where we sell this know-how effectively to other companies that want to do lending, but they don't want to do it themselves. Maybe it's not their core business. Maybe they just understand it's a lot of detail and so on and so forth. So we are looking for ideally financial institutions that want to provide consumer loans as part of their offering to their existing customer base or a new customer base, but they want somebody else to do that for them. Yes. And so New School is just a package of all the experience, knowledge, and understanding of how to run consumer lending business that we've acquired over the, 10 plus years. And we want to sell it as a service. Yes.
And that implies that the business that we are doing holistically can be chopped into segments, right? Our target customer for New School would be a neobank that has, regulation, IT, and clients, but they don't know how to do lending. Or it could be a payment gateway or a payment processing company that has digital wallets, they have KYC AML, but they don't know how to do lending, right? So we would integrate with them, they all of a sudden would have a button to get a loan to their customers, yeah. Right? So that's, high level.
Is that from my understanding, big benefit from the networking perspective, because in a way it sounds like you're nurturing, let's say, kind of competitors in a way.
Yes and no. I mean, it's a good question. So if we were to do that in Jordan and provide our white label lending know-how to some Jordanian company that also wants to do consumer loans, and we are in the meantime a dominating consumer lender there ourselves, it could be a bit kind of tricky, or it would not maybe make that much sense. So I would suppose we're looking at markets where we are not active with our own lending businesses, and in that case there's no conflict of interest or no problem.
But the more because we're expanding our business reach, the more of lending is happening in any given market, the better, because we're going to be tailoring the infrastructure from one end to another, from scoring to providing financing to buying bad debt portfolios, right? So the more is happening in any given market, the better. And from that perspective, New School is a great opportunity for companies to make extra revenue on their clients and on their infrastructure, because they have some sort of regulation and they've invested there, right? Mm-hmm. So adding extra revenue from a lending product for many companies is just, you know, the only way to go to become profitable. Some people don't know how to do it, and they choose not to do it. But here we are with a helping hand, to improve their businesses. Mm-hmm.
And maybe just one last thing, the gatekeeping aspect, because I remember from seeing one of your videos, you're also like, okay, there's like, you know, there's a lot of money in this market, and coming from Europe, kind of looking to do business then in the Middle East. How's the gatekeeping, and how good you need to be at connecting, networking with certain people to have also your business running in the Middle East?
What do you mean by gatekeeping?
He means like you can't do business there without local partners and families and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. So how do we manage that aspect?
How big is it and how do you manage it?
So, yeah, it's a big aspect. Pretty much you can't do business there without that. And, that's been years of relationship building, traveling to the countries and, you know, actually making sure that you have those, you know, Sheikh families and people to refer to, and to have those people on your cap table in order they allow through a king to have that business there. Otherwise, it's simply not going to happen, which we are very happy for, of course, you know, because you can't just go there, open a company and start operating. If somebody thinks that's the case, you know, couldn't be more wrong. You know, sometimes an entry to a market takes 3-4 years, just an entry. I'm not talking about developing.
So. All right. That was some interesting insights into the lending operations in the Middle East. Thanks so much for sharing. There would be one last topic, but I think we discussed this then later on with the safety of funds and the recent incident we had on the Skettet. But I think since we are overdue with the time, thanks so much for answering a couple of questions. Much appreciate, and
cool, man.
Success.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Have a good podcast. Yeah. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
Thank you.